morning. Nice to see y'all. I'm going to talk a little bit today about not giving up. Not giving up. And I'm going to talk about this a lot coming out of the song of the Grassroof Hermitage. I think you guys all have chant books. Probably one for every two person. So if you just want to open those up, and if you look, you'll find a hard-to-read tab that says Midday Session. Come on in. And on the Midday Session tab, you can find the Song of the Grassroof Hermitage. So once you've found it, you can just we're going to take a minute to align our bodies and our minds for chanting. So chanting may be very familiar to some of you or unfamiliar, but I think chanting's pretty good. We have a culture where we emphasize consumption rather than creation. We emphasize a lot of thinking rather than embodiment. We emphasize individualism over collectivism. So when we chant, we have an opportunity to reclaim something really basic about what it is to be human, which is our togetherness, our being in a body, and our creating something together. So I could just bring in a boombox and play you a tape of someone chanting. But I think it's a little better if we just do it together. So let's all just first find some room in the breath. So just draw your spine long and draw some breaths deep into your belly. And we'll allow the chanting emerge from the breath. And then draw the awareness to the sensations of hearing. So let's just allow this chant to arise from breath and listening. Song of the Grassroof Hermitage. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. When it was completed, fresh weeds appeared. Now it's been lived in, covered by weeds. The person in the hut lives here calmly. Not stuck to inside, outside, or in between. Places worldly people live, he doesn't live. Realms worldly people love, he doesn't love. Though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. In 10 square feet, 10 old men illumines forms and their nature. A great vehicle, Bodhisattva, trusts without doubt. The middling or lowly can't help wondering, will this hut perish or not? Perishable or not, the original master is present, not dwelling south or north, east or west. Firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. A shining window below the green pines. Jade palaces or vermilion towers can't compare with it. Just sitting with head covered, all things are at rest. Thus this mountain monk doesn't understand at all. Living here, he no longer works to get free. Who would proudly arrange seats trying to entice guests? turn around the light to shine within, then just return. The vast inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. Meet the ancestral teachers, be familiar with their instruction. Bind the grasses to build a hut, and don't give up. Let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. Thousands of words, myriad interpretations, are only to free you from obstructions. If you want to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from the skin bag here and now.
All right, and how about if we just pass the chant books back and put them up on the radiators? We've been trying to keep them off the floor lately. A little nod to tradition. So, this poem was written 1,300 years ago by a guy named Shi Tu. And he gives us the impression that he's taking it pretty easy. Nothing wrong with relaxing and taking a nap. But although he talks so much about being calm and taking it easy and letting go, relaxing completely, he also says, bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. And he also says that what he's talking about is firmly based on steadiness. So, you know, this is written in a context where there are some people who are, let's see, what's the term? Hard ass. You can find some Chinese Zen where, you know, these guys are, well, I don't sleep at all anymore. I just meditate all the time. No. Actually, they don't sleep all the time. They would just stay up till about midnight meditating, then get up at 3. All right, so everybody on board? So these guys were really, there was this culture that was very intense about practice. And so to some extent, this poem represents a response or a dialectic to that tendency. At the same time, it's just kind of helpful because a lot of times I get going, trying to get everything done all the time in my busy American life. And so I have a little reminder here with Shi Tu. Oh, take it easy. But the possibility for the ease that Shi Tu talks about here is very clearly based on steady practice, firmly based on steadiness, and on a profound commitment. I want to read a little something out of this book that I wrote that came out a couple months ago about this poem. I like talking about this poem, it turns out. Yeah, so I'm going to read a couple pages here. This chapter is called The Foundation of Freedom. And it's a response to the line, firmly based on steadiness, it can't be surpassed. Autumn is beginning in Minnesota, where I live, and the leaves are beginning to lose their deep green and gain a soft yellow. The kids I love are getting older, leaving behind kid things and finding adult ones. My mom says that since her knees are going, this is the last year she will be able to go on our family backpacking trip into the mountains. Weeds are growing all over our grass hut. Fresh weeds. Today I'm heading down to a rural retreat center, Hokyoji, where I'll be bathed in the evidence of the changes fall brings. The cool, the colors, the birds heading south. There I will immerse myself in steady practice, moving slowly, sitting still, living in a way that allows me to give my whole attention to tying my shoes, cooking rice, and having tea. This commitment to steadiness is the doorway to the unsurpassable freedom the Dharma offers. Sometimes Buddhists use words to stretch the bounds of consciousness, but more often we recommend the practice of simplicity. Steadiness amid change is a common theme in Buddhist literature. Early teachings recommend training the mind to stay concentrated on the coming and going of things, their appearance, and their passing away. Without this kind of training, the body and the mind tend to be swept up in a reactive froth of emotion and thought. On the radio, we hear the voice of a politician we disagree with, and our body tenses. The mind starts to fire off a string of thoughts about his faults, the stupidity of his supporters, the disaster that will befall us if he is successful. Or we hear the politician we love and we feel encouraged and supported, perhaps self-righteous and superior. This kind of reactivity doesn't just keep us from being at ease. It reduces our potential to help other people by trapping us in our self-centered views. Shitu uses various terms for calm and ease numerous times in this poem, but here he says firmly based on steadiness. The promise that this poem holds out for us is not realized by just relaxing, by just being at our ease, but takes a firm commitment to practice. And the main practice, the practice that supports all others, is sitting meditation. The Chinese characters translated here as firmly based on steadiness could also be roughly translated as foundation, sight, firm, strong. They all mean like one thing. You're lucky you're not a translator of Chinese poetry. Me too. When we sit down to meditate, we make a firm foundation. At my place of practice, we encourage our meditators to find a way of sitting that is strongly rooted. In a chair, we find the right height to support an upright posture. On a meditation cushion, we make sure the knees are on the ground so the body is well balanced. A stable body is the foundation for stillness for practice. I recall sitting in Hokyoji Zen practice community Zendo while a storm raged outside, deeply hearing the roar of the rain on the roof and the crack of nearby thunder while the temperature inside fell and all was completely still. 20 people sitting soft, strong, and steady together. So far in this poem, Shitu shows a monk at ease, relaxed amid change, attuned to the vastness, and taking care of the small things. Now he's brought us a reminder that the foundation of this life is meditation, a mind that's not swept away. His audience at the time he wrote was mostly monks who are very devoted to Buddhist practice, so he started with ease to remind them to not get stuck on the idea of struggling to realize the way, of having the very firmest foundation of all. When practice gets intense and feels like a struggle, it's often good to recall the message of ease. But most of us today are not monks, and might be taking our practice pretty easy already. If you do not have a firm and steady practice as a regular part of your life, and the message of this poem resonates with you, find the practice. Find support for the practice. The promise of this poem of Buddhism is not realized without a commitment to meditation. We can stay here, right now, on our foundation, and we can offer ourselves the chance to find our place through meditation. So, I'm kind of focusing on really making this commitment and sticking with it. Let's see. How many times have I been sitting in meditation and been like, it must have been an hour already, mustn't it? Maybe I'll just check my clock. Maybe my clock broke. Maybe space-time has folded in on itself. Or when I'm in here in the Zendo, you know, maybe the Doan has died. The bell will never ring. He's smiling, though, so we're safe today. But many things can cause us to give up on this practice. And, you know, I do this practice because I want to devote my life in the best way I can to the well-being of the world. And That will be a theme here. Come on in. Plenty of places to sit. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about this thing I like to do, which is go into the mountains and do meditation practice and Zen retreat practice while backpacking, so carrying everything that I have with me on my back, walking around with my friends. So I've been doing these retreats now for 4 years, and I'm going to talk principally about a single one today. And I noticed, it sounds pretty fun. People like to go to Glacier National Park and go backpacking the mountains because it's really beautiful and it's fun, which is true. But I noticed that I rarely talk about these during Dharma talks, but when I do, I always talk about something horrible that happened. Because I'm kind of a salesman. And I was just thinking about that, and my tendency to talk about the more difficult aspects of the practice. And this is pretty consistent with Buddhist literature. If you read like lots of Pali Canon texts, the earliest record of Buddhism, the Buddha, he comes across as kind of a negative dude. You know, he starts out, I'm going to talk about suffering, that's first. Although, that's a little confusing because actually he says, I'm going to talk about how to go beyond suffering. But we have to acknowledge that if there's no suffering, why bother having a path? So, but there's a lot of stuff about non-self, non-attachment, non-craving. There's not a lot about, this is awesome, you're going to get what you want. Every once in a while, there's a few where someone says, you know, you're always talking about all this, how this kind of negative view of what practice does. You know, isn't it? Is it good? And he's like, oh, yeah, it's totally blissful. It's a really short sutra. It's kind of funny. But he doesn't go that way very much. And, of course, there's probably a lot of reasons, but the principal one is because if we say this practice is going to get you what you want, then you'll just turn your practice into the same thing that makes your whole rest of your life have problems. Because the fundamental problem, he says, is you want something other than what's here. So, and of course, there is a whole aspect of the teaching that's about getting something else. But they try, by talking about getting it, having it be something else, they talk about something else that you can't own, that you can't grasp. So there's lots of ways to try and find a way to make this practice be non-acquisitive. And of course, my favorite is the Bodhisattva vows that we chant at the end of every Sunday talk, which are about offering your whole life to the possibility of wellness for everything, for everyone. A completely inconceivable and irrational type of vow to make. Because how can you liberate beings from suffering that you'll never meet throughout space and time? I don't know. But I keep making the vow. Because the vow is about me surrendering the part of me that's trying to get something out of life and awaken the part of me that's about trying to give myself to life. Because when I give myself to life, that's when real freedom arises. And the only freedom that really matters for me is the freedom from my own churning mind that turns life into, oh, if only it would stop raining. Oh, if only they would stop talking. Oh, if only, you know, if only, if only, if only. So this vow is big. And we keep reiterating it here every Sunday because, of course, if we don't, we'll forget because we're humans. So we're kind of dumb. No, that's not right. We're conditioned. We're conditioned to just fall back into having life be about just trying to, how can I get what I want? How can I figure out how these conditions are either what I want and try and hold on to them or not what I want and get rid of them? So this vow is big. It's a big vow. Reaches everywhere. And I just keep trying to draw it into my heart. Because with that vow, there will be, I have found the possibility of some liberation. So I want to talk a little bit about this poem by a woman named Padachara. Padachara was one of the earliest Buddhist nuns, and she was a great teacher with a lot of women who studied under her, practiced the way. She's also a person who had an unbelievably awful and traumatic life, the trauma of which was so extreme that she basically was completely crazy. She was living naked with matted hair and eating garbage on the outskirts of towns for a long time until the Buddha happened upon her. And although she had been shunned for many years, he just came up and started talking to her. And she devoted herself to practice for many years, and it was hard. She had a long road, out of how bad things were for her. But she just kept doing it. She did not give up. So here's this poem by Padachara, and I'll just preface it by saying she starts by talking about kind of a conventional way of living where the high-class people, the Brahmins, where farmers, they're just doing their job and they get rich and that looks pretty good. She's not doing that. She's like, if that works for them, I'm doing the Buddha way. Why isn't it working for me? And then there's a kind of a shift in the time frame, and she talks about something else. So this poem goes, when they sow seeds in the earth, when they plow their fields, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right. I follow the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I trained my mind the way you train a good horse. I took a lamp and went into my hut, checked the bed and sat down on it, took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. So I can identify with this. I've done everything right. I followed the rule of my teacher. I think I'm doing okay, right, Tim? So, you know, I'm doing it. I've been sitting in this damn Zendo for all these years. Wall. And my mind is still just, you know, boring thoughts, pointless thoughts, angry thoughts. Why haven't I found peace? I'm going to get out of here. This is dumb. I'm wasting my time. I could be doing something important like, Oh, there are important things that I could do. I'm joking. You know, I thought, oh, I could become a psychologist and I could actually sit down with people and help. You know, become a doctor. They get something done, right? Maybe I should do that. Although I would probably throw up. So that's not a good choice. Anyway, you know, I get discouraged. I've had periods where I feel like, I mean, geez, when I first quit drinking and using drugs, I'm a recovering alcoholic all those years ago, it was like every day all I did was just try and stay sober. And everything still sucked. Why haven't I found peace? I'm trying so hard here. So that was kind of extreme, but even maybe, you know, things are going pretty well for you. But you're like, you know, I do my sitting every day. I go down to Zen Center on Sundays. And it's still, you know, I sit down with my mom and I'm like, what's wrong with you? So, you know, we get discouraged. But, you know, if you look at the language of this verse, I've done everything right. I follow the rule of my teacher. I follow the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? I. Why don't I have what I want? Peace. Because you're looking for something else. What if you just throw your whole life at the practice? Just offer yourself to what is. That includes how crazy your mind is. How crazy your mind is not separate from the rest of the universe. How crazy your heart is not something other than all the rest of the universe. It's all part of the deal. That's just one thing that in every moment you can say, I offer myself to you. Here we are. How do we offer? We just pay attention. We got the dumbest practice in the world here. Just pay attention with your whole heart. I think it's kind of interesting that then, what happens? She recounts, there's like a shift in the time frame, right? And then she's talking in the past tense, but it's clear this is another side of things, because she's talking about when she found some liberation. And she doesn't talk about liberation through vow. She talks about liberation through very carefully doing simple things. Bathing the feet. Watching the water. The bathing water. Just being in the shower, watching the water run down the drain. Watching the water run down your legs. Instead of being in the shower and thinking, how soon am I going to be able to pick up my son? How am I going to resolve this conflict at work? What am I going to make for dinner? You can just watch the water. Right outside the bathroom here, we used to have a little picture, just a bunch of bodhisattvas bathing. What are they doing? They're just bathing. I can't remember, there's a koan about it. Do the bodhisattvas enjoy it when they're bathing? Sure! And she just takes a light, goes into her room, checks the bed. We're lucky. We don't have to check our bed. There are no scorpions here, no snakes, no bugs. But you can still just notice, I've got a bed. It's a pretty good deal. Pretty good deal just to be here. About ready to get in bed. Just paying attention to simple, simple things. That's really our practice here. Pretty simple. Awareness of what's here. Just offering your whole attention is actually all the offering you really need to do. This giving yourself up to life isn't. You know, it's not like you can find your life and, oh, I'll take it out of my box and I'll give it to you. You just give your awareness because that's all you are. Actually, I don't know what you are, but you start drilling down. Starts to look like maybe your awareness is you. Keep drilling. What will you find? So we're not in the mountains a couple weeks ago. Jenny and I don't know if anyone else was here or was there. And it was pretty cool. You know, I go on these mindfulness in the mountains trips and I'm teaching like it, so I talk a lot, kind of a motor mouth. And the theme of these trips really is about not going to the mountains to try and get something for yourself, but going to the mountains to offer yourself to the practice of doing simple things with your wholehearted awareness. So basically enacting a vow instead of just enacting your karma. And, there's two sides of it because it is unbelievably, staggeringly beautiful there all the time. So that's pretty good. You know, I get a little hungry. I'm like, ooh, I like this. You know, I get there and you get on the trail and it's like the views are opening up and there are these trees that are amazing and various. And there's rivers and clouds. Spent all this time on one of the trips this year, just I was watching clouds come over the Continental Divide from big puffy clouds to just disappearing in a span of about 10 minutes. In a span of about maybe 2 miles of travel by the clouds. Beautiful. waterfalls. Ah, how many 500 and 1,000 foot tall waterfalls did I see in the last couple months? 30. I don't know. This is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous place. But although you can see, I'm like, ooh, I really like this. My practice is to just offer myself to being aware of that's there and just letting it flow right through me, but not hold on. Because if all it is I come home from this trip and I go, man, I want to go back to the mountains. What good did that do? What I'm hoping is I go to the mountains and I come here and I go, wow, amazing. Look at how beautiful all these people in this room are. Look at this. Incredible. And just let it flow through me. Look at these people trying to devote themselves to something. Maybe they don't even understand what it is. Amazing. Candle. How long has that candle been burning on Katagiri's altar? Every day someone gets up and lights that. Someone gets up and puts it out. Amazing. This is the training of the waterfall. To learn to just let it be there, but not grab it. But it's dangerous, you know. Because I'm like, I want to go back to the mountains. Yeah. Beauty and wonderful things, they're conducive to attachment. That's very real. Desire. So anyway, we went down there, and it was really beautiful and amazing, and I'm hanging out with my friends, and it was really nice. And then it got really cloudy, and then it started raining, and then it got kind of cold. And I thought, I'm not sure I like this quite as much. So on this trip we were on, it was a 6-day trip, and what, I think it rained for about 3.5 days. Does that sound right? Or was it like 6 months? So we were getting rained on, and, you know, we came down, and I thought, well, I've been talking about how this practice is not about getting something for yourself, but about giving yourself to what is. So yeah, I have to start out. It's so beautiful when you get there. You got to start out by going, don't just start grasping. But I'm like, we're going to have to shift gears here and start saying, how do we be intimate? How do we manifest our vow when things are not quite as nice as we like? Because I don't know if any of you guys are like outdoors people, but it's a common association of rain with not good when you're outside. And if you're backpacking, there's a little extra thing because there's not somewhere dry you get to go. You get to think, maybe some of my stuff will be dry tomorrow. So, you know, and there's real concerns. It's like, oh, you could get really cold and get hypothermia. So I started to experience some aversion. But, you know, we just stayed with this thing. You know, okay, so maybe we're worrying about things, or maybe it's like, oh, I don't like this as much. But, you know, we have a little check-in every day. We talk about our commitment. And, you know, the rain was, it just kept going. And also there's an interesting, you know, mountains are tall. I don't know if you know about this. They're tall. And clouds sometimes are not. So, actually, after the first couple days, a few days of this trip, we couldn't see any mountains. Well, I mean, if you consider the trees at the bottom of the mountain to be a mountain, you could see the mountains. But they're just clouds. And, you know, they're like, you can reach up and touch them. Because they're probably about 500 feet above the valley floor, which is pretty tall around here. But considering the mountains are another 4,000 feet up, you know, you're missing out. I came here all the way to see mountains, and what I see is the clouds. They got clouds in Minnesota. So you know, the people on this trip, they're having various feelings and thoughts, but I'm sure some of them were, hey, I wanted to have, you know, mountain views. So there's this aversion. But we just stayed with this theme. We're going to get up in the morning and meditate. And we're going to take care of our simple things. We're going to pack up our tents as best we can and keep things as dry as best as we can. And we're going to walk to the next place we have to go. And we're going to walk in the rain. And we're not going to sit and talk about something else. We're not going to sit and complain about how it's raining. And we're not going to sit and talk about how won't it be great when we get home and we can have a steak. And we're not going to just make jokes. We're actually just going to be present to what is. Which is not easy. When you come in here and sit down on a really good day and you're feeling calm and you sit on that cushion, you may be like, this is pretty good. But the first time you come in here when you've just had a really big fight with your husband and you sit down on that cushion, you'd be like, Zazen sucks. Thank you very much. This is hard. Because you're actually just close to your life when you want to run away. But if you can be close to your life when you want to run away, you see how strong you are. You see how strong you are, that you don't have to run away from life. And that tendency to turn life into something you want to run away from is also softened over time. But anyway, we just kept marching, and you know, we're not talking. So but my problem is I get to spend a lot of time out there, so I'm like, well, this is kind of interesting and novel. But I'm like worried about the people I brought here. You know, they came so far, and they planned all year, and oh, geez, you know, how are they doing? That's my problem. I take care of my own little reactivity. But anyway, we marched along, and it kept raining, and it rained another day. And then, but I kept saying, let's just do our practice. Let's see what this yields. And we had our check-in on the fifth day, and someone said, you know, I've started thinking about leaving yesterday. And I was thinking, well, it's raining. That's not so good. Let's just get out of here. Or maybe I'll just tell those guys I'm taking off and I'll go home. And I've been thinking about that on and off all day for 2 days. And then he says, then suddenly, and I was like just kind of complaining, it's raining, it kind of sucks, it's cold, it's muddy as hell, can't see anything. Does this sound familiar? And he says, suddenly I just realized, this is not something I'm doing for me. I came here to do bodhisattva practice. That's why I came here. And he says, suddenly the whole load of my aversion evaporated. Because I realized I'm doing something that's way bigger than just do I get what I want. And he said, the rest of the day has been awesome. Liberated. Liberated from making life into how do I get what I want? By giving yourself to what is. But he had to stay with it. And we just stayed with it. We were sitting at Elizabeth Lake. It was rainy and wet. Clouds. 300 or 400 feet above our heads. And I was so cold. I was like, I'm cold. I got to get in my sleeping bag. But then when I'd sit zazen, I'd be totally warm. How did that happen? Sitting at the roots of trees. So the last day, there's this famous route called the Ptarmigan Tunnel Trail. It's one of the most famous routes in Glacier Park because there's unbelievably vast views all over the place from the time you start till the time you get down. So, you know, we're sitting the whole time going, well, the weather, they did forecast that it would clear up on the fifth day, but it didn't. I said, well, maybe the forecast it will clear up on the sixth day, a little later than planned. So we got on the trail, and it was very cloudy. And we said, well, we're just going to do our practice. And we started up there. And we made our commitment together. And we kept climbing, and we had been below the clouds when we started, but we had 2,500 feet up to go. So we just went right into the clouds. So after about a mile, the visibility was reduced to about 50 or 60 yards, where it remained for the majority of the rest of the trip. And we just did it. And I've been on that trail many times, and it was amazing. There were individual plants on this trail. We walked for about 12 miles. I went back there the next week with a different group, and I remember these individual plants I never would have seen before. Because I've always been looking over there. Oh, there's a glacier over there. But these plants were amazing. Springing out of bare rock. How do you live in that environment? Amazing. And we realize something that is always true when we think things are obscured. That nothing is ever obscured. It's just, there's not something else. There's no other moment. There's just this. It's just fog. It's just clouds. So I don't have to wait. What is it that's going to be on the other side of that? I can just offer myself to this whiteness, vast whiteness. Steep slope up to the left, white. In front, white. The sky down below me, below the cliff, white. A vast emptiness. And it cleared up a little bit as we came down, which was fun. We saw a grizzly bear running up across a slope. Was the grizzly bear really worried? I hate these rainy days. So, I don't know. It was kind of hard. But we did it. And we didn't give up on our commitment to practice. So I want to just read a little something out of this book again. Towards the end of this Song of the Grass for Hermitage, Shitu says, bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. Just do a simple task of taking care of your life. You've got to have a hut. It's not that warm in southern China, in the mountains. So you got to build a hut. You got to do something. This isn't just like lie down and let everything happen, dude. Bind grasses to build a hut and don't give up. The characters in this line of the poem translated here as don't give up could very well be translated instead as don't back off. By the way, I got that from those of you who like this sort of stuff. Red Pine sent me that. Red Pine's pretty cool. The characters in this line of the poem translated here as don't give up could very well be translated instead as don't back off. Don't back off from the challenge of your deepest aspirations. Don't back off from what is here, right now. To really see what life is in this moment, to devote ourselves to being well and helping others, these are challenges the mind is not habituated to take on. It takes courage to just sit down and meditate. It's not easy to sit down and really look at how completely out of control our thinking is. It's hard to sit and be really intimate with our emotions. It's hard to have faith that just sitting still and feeling the rise and fall of our bellies as we watch thoughts and sounds come and go is a profoundly generous act of service to the world. It's hard to have faith that letting go of our fixed views and cultivating a mind that has some openness to whatever arises is good for all of us. We get busy. We get anxious. We get pissed. We get excited about something. And we want. And we back away from what's here and retreat into our mind's projections. We give up. But we can always come back. Trying again only takes a moment. This is the one. At our Zen Center, we have practice periods every spring and fall. For 8 weeks, a big group of people make formal commitments to meditation practice, retreat, group study, mindful work, and kindness. At the beginning of our weekly meetings, we go around the circle and check in with each other to see how we're doing with our commitments to practice. It's quite common for people to say that they haven't done as much sitting meditation as they had planned because they got very busy. A few years ago, however, my friend Matt said, I'm extremely busy with a couple of big projects. I've got an album coming out soon, and I just got my first job scoring a theater production, Plus, I have my full-time job. So, I'm going to do a little more meditation than I planned to help it all go well. This statement seems so completely bizarre and so exactly right. I have never spent so much time sitting that I wasn't able to get my other obligations done. But the more I commit to practice, the better everything in my life goes. Everything changes, and certainly a time may come when we may need to move on from Buddhism, or it may be true that we're not yet ready to begin practice. If we're moving on because we know in our heart another path is right for us, that's good. But we need to investigate why we're doing this. Are we backing off from something really important to us? Are we giving up just because we're discouraged or unmotivated? We may run into emotional roadblocks. Our teachers may disappoint us. Perhaps we move away from our community of practice, or maybe we're busy with children. We may just keep cracking open the laptop and scrolling through Facebook pages instead of meditating. No one ever does that. Especially me. I know there's only so much time in a day, and we all make our own choices about what's best. You may only have a little bit of your life to give to Buddhist practice. That's okay. The message here is don't give up on the present moment. Don't give up on what really matters to you. Your capacity to grow and help others is unlimited. You have gained the pivotal opportunity of being human. Find the support you need. Find a way that is kind to you to support yourself, to support those you love, to grow the circle of those you love. Don't give up and don't back off from this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity shining in the moment. Well, I think that's what I want to say today. And I talked for longer than I planned, so... we probably have a minute or two if anyone wants to say something or ask a question. We have a few minutes. So if anyone would like to say something or ask something.
What about the giving up, this phrase, giving up, don't give up. It's so interesting, that phrase. It says, of course, what we need to do all the time is give up. So it's a really interesting kind of thing. I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Well, I think it's true. I mean, what we're trying to do is don't give up giving up. Just give up every moment, but don't give up on that. Right? Very good. Don't give up on completely surrendering yourself to what is. Yeah.
I have a regular meditation practice, and for the last 6 months, I've also been doing this new martial art, which is a lot of fun for me. And I think about my practice in both those areas, and I step into a class after a long day of work, a martial arts class, and am addled and agitated at all the things that have transpired during the day, and have to settle down and work with other people and apply what my practice has taught me and this conditioning that I subject myself to, and I go in thinking I can rely on all this practice that I've done. It's like I've got a safe somewhere, bank deposit, that all this practice is accumulating in, and when I go and I need to interact with people and that I can draw on this reserve of practice. And it was just recently that wasn't the case. There was nothing there. There was just nothing in the bank. But in so many other places, my point is that in so many other places in our lives, we work in a transactional way where we are drawing down resources here and drawing and putting resources in here. You know, there is an actual bank with money in it. That's how I pay my rent. But it's nice that in maybe some other arenas there, you don't have the opportunity to accrue something actually, and that's freedom in itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very nice. Well, wonderful. I think perhaps we should move along to the next phase of our morning.